We're talking about school choice here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Vice President Mike Pence spoke in the rotunda of the state capitol Tuesday, celebrating Wisconsin's voucher school program. It started in Milwaukee 30 years ago, and it's grown in scope here and straight across the nation.
Wisconsin has an extraordinary record of success with school choice, and every family in Wisconsin should be proud.
So what's your take on Wisconsin's voucher program? What do you want to know? We're at 800-642-1234. Jim Bender is president of School Choice Wisconsin. It's an advocacy organization based in Brookfield. Jim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So Wisconsin created the statewide school choice program in 2013, a statewide program allowing families to use, private dollars toward private and religious schools. How is this program working so far?
Fabulously. It's an extension, obviously, of the program that was started in Milwaukee. So there are really three programs in Wisconsin, geographically based, and a special needs scholarship program. Milwaukee and Racine have their own programs, and the rest of the state is the Wisconsin Parental Choice Program. It's the smallest of the three as far as enrollment, but the largest of the three as for the number of participating schools. So you've got schools now really scattered all over the state that are in the program that have quite a bit of physical capacity, and almost all of those schools are growing. So you're going to see there's about 9,700 students in about 260 schools in the Wisconsin program. There's another more than 30,000 in Milwaukee and Racine. So we got 9,700 students in about 260 schools. We know from our work, because we've been in all 260 schools as an organization, We know there's a lot more coming online, and we know the existing schools are feeling a great deal of demand from parents. So that number is going to go up rather significantly in the next 5 years.
So you see growing capacity in the next years. You also see growing demand?
Oh, there's constant demand. I mean, that's the only way you get growth. I mean, again, for a school to participate, it's a voluntary endeavor. A private school has to enroll with DPI, has to submit to three audits a year, an online application system. Their staff has to get trained. There's all sorts of rules and regulations to go with it. So it's a big leap for a school to get in. A school's not going to do that if they don't think that there's not going to be a demand from parents. And once they do get into the program, oftentimes what happens is then they get an even greater demand. And so even their expectations that they're putting out there, in many cases, we've seen that happen. And so the program is capped kind of in an odd way now by individual public school district. And so that goes up 1% a year. It's 4% of a public school district right now is eligible for a voucher. We've hit that cap in a number of districts. And so next year it'll go to 5%, 6%. And instead of going to 11% from 10%, then the cap is removed. So that's under current law. That's the way the statutes are written. So as that progresses, we think that those numbers will certainly continue to rise.
Vice President Mike Pence, strong advocate for school choice programs in Indiana, where he was governor. What did he have to say about Wisconsin's program at his visit at the Capitol yesterday?
Well, he recognized the successes that we're having. So, he talked about Cristo Rey in Milwaukee, which is a school that's now in its fifth year. It's a high school. They started as just a freshman class and added a grade per year. And their first graduating class had 85 students in it, and I'm pulling this off memory, but I think they had 86 when they started. So 85 of the 86 that started came through, graduated high school, and all of them got into college. And all 85 students are the first member of their family to ever go to college.
First generation.
First generation. So the valedictorian was there yesterday. And she joined 21 of her classmates from Cristo Rey as freshmen at Marquette. So it's not just getting into school, but, almost a third of those students qualified to get into Marquette. So, that's really an unbelievable accomplishment for a school that's now, not surprisingly, busting at the seams. They are going to build a new building because they have so much demand from parents to get their children into a school like that. So that's one of the many examples that he talked about in the Capitol yesterday.
Talking with Jim Bender, the president of School Choice Wisconsin, Vice President Mike Pence spoke about Wisconsin's leadership in the area of school voucher programs. He was at the state capitol yesterday. Jim, a bill proposed by Representative Jonathan Brostoff, a Democrat from Milwaukee, would basically dismantle the state's voucher program. It's called the Public Education Reinvestment Act. You oppose this bill, but what changes would you like lawmakers to work on in public education?
Oh, boy. I think the place you have to start, so – and I'll comment about Brostoff here in a minute, but they just had a Blue Ribbon Commission. And, well, personally, I'm not all that big a fan of Blue Ribbon Commissions because they make a lot of reports and not much happens out of it. But nonetheless, they did have a Blue Ribbon Commission on public education funding. And in Wisconsin, there's a lot of different dynamics. Public School District A can get $2,000 less per child than Public School District B. And then you have a voucher that has, you know, $8,000 per child and a public school student that gets $12,500 per child. So you've got inequities kind of all over the place, depending on your sector and your system and charter and other things. So we're not funding equally per student, right? There's all sorts of different things, and that's not sector specific. It can go all over. The other thing that's really changed in the last 30 years, you've got 43,500 students in the voucher program. You've got 15,000 independent charters. You've got more than 60,000 in public school open enrollment. And if you count district charters, you've got 42,000 students in district charters. When you total that all up, you've got nearly 18.5, it's nearly 20% of all the publicly funded children in Wisconsin are now attending a school that's not their traditional resident public school district.
In their neighborhood.
Their neighborhood school, what their residentially assigned neighborhood would be. And what that means for a funding formula, on the public school side, you've got all these different things, three-year rolling averages and things that are meant to smooth out enrollment and funding and all those things, you don't get dips. And they were really designed around a system where when you met your mandatory requirement, you either went to the local private school and paid for it, or you went to your local public school and that was it. It's very different now. Children are moving all over the place, but our financial system is not meant to follow the child. The money needs to follow the child. So for me, the two big things that I testified to is get equal funding per child, and you need to figure out a way to make that money much more mobile, because that's what our population is now. They're moving all over.
Last October, the Department of Public Instruction said it spent nearly $350 million on vouchers. Opponents of vouchers are arguing that voucher programs are siphoning off resources from already underfunded public schools. So does the state have a duty to ensure that public schools are properly funded and continue a voucher program? Can you do both? Well,
absolutely. And that's a really loaded question, because when, you know, you get the underfunded, you get all the different kind of buzzwords that go into that question. Parents that put their child into the voucher program are not second class citizens. They're taxpayers just like everybody else. We live in a state where it's mandatory. Either you're homeschooling or you have to send your children to school. Okay? You have many options to meet that mandatory requirement. Virtual schools, private schools, paid for or not, doesn't matter. You have to do that. All we're talking about doing is being able to take the dollars that you're paying in via your taxes, that all of the families in the voucher program are taxpayers, right? They all are. You get to redirect your dollars to the school of your choice. The public school system is one delivery method of public education. There are many other ways to do it. The idea that it is always going to be a one-size-fits-all system, one, isn't reality, right? That is clearly not the demand of the people. And we've seen in polling, Republican, Democrat, they support school choice. The younger generations certainly support school choice. So the advent that we are going to keep a one-size-fits-all system, whether you like it or not, isn't reality. That's not what we're talking about. And I think back to your previous question, if you got to a more equitable system on funding per student, there are some issues that the public school folks certainly can make around funding and education disparities amongst themselves, much less an overall funding mechanism. But I think if you got to more mobile funding and more equitable funding, some of those issues would be taken off the table.
Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Jim Bender is president of School Choice Wisconsin. Coming up, Goodwill of Southeast Wisconsin turned 100. We discuss the company's work and its impact on local communities. This is The Morning Show. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the work of Goodwill Industries of Southeastern Wisconsin over a century. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So Goodwill was founded on this premise that secondhand goods can get a second chance, second lease on life, and people can also get a second chance to earn both a paycheck and their independence. Nearly 5,700 Goodwill employees work in more than 90 locations throughout its 23-county territory, in the southeastern part of our state and in Metro Chicago. So do you shop at Goodwill? Why do you shop there? Have you been part of Goodwill's employment services or its other social enterprises? Share your story, 800-642-1234. Pat Bolter is Chief Marketing Officer for Goodwill Industries of Southeastern Wisconsin. Pat, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate, and good morning.
100 years is a long time.
Lots
has changed. There's lots of need. You know, how have you seen Goodwill change over those 100 years?
Well, Goodwill, you know, we've had a lot of impact throughout those 100 years. And basically, as an organization, we've always responded to the needs of the time since our founding. And since we are 100 years old, I'm going to go back in history a little bit. And give you some examples of that. Like during the World Wars, you know, we provided training and work opportunities for thousands of injured soldiers that returned from the war. And also we collected salvage for the war effort. And the Great Depression of the 1930s, you know, we had unemployment rates in Milwaukee of nearly 25%. And we have photos of the city's jobless who, you know, formed very long lines and looked to us for employment. And we responded basically providing temporary employers, hundreds of them, so they could, you know, feed their families during that awful time in our history. And then we saw in 1990s the passage of the American with Disabilities Act. And, of course, that civil rights law prohibits discrimination based on a disability. And Goodwill was really at the forefront of that legislation. And then the Great Depression, we all remember, the Great Recession, rather, we remember that in 2008. That went really until almost 2010, 2011. And we responded to those high unemployment rates that were happening in Milwaukee and opened up several workforce connection centers in Wisconsin and actually in Illinois as well that provided free resources for anyone who needed help in finding work. So throughout history, I think we've been responding to the needs of the times.
We've also seen the evolution. I mean, there was the thrift store model, which has endured the test of time. But there's also been other enterprises like shredding documents and laundering services. How have those gone?
Well, you know, there's a lot more to Goodwill than just the Goodwill stores and donation centers. But that's pretty much the public-facing portion of the organization. But let me just tell you a little bit about some of the other things that we do. For example, we have a laundry and linen operation. It's a commercial laundry operation that we've had since the mid-1970s. And today we process over 15 million pounds of linen each year. And these are individuals with disabilities and disadvantages, and they're able to gain some very valuable, you know, work and life skills through these operations. Most people are unaware that we have a huge operation at Goodwill Great Lakes, which is Naval Station Great Lakes. It's all the sailors and recruits that go through boot camp there. And we provide food service and laundry and administrative and even logistics services for those sailors and recruits. And every year we prepare and serve about 9 million meals. We issue all of the uniforms and process millions of pieces of mail for the U.S. Navy. And we have nearly 600 people with disabilities that work at that operation for us at Naval Station Great Lakes. Another example folks may not know, we have TalentBridge, which is a full-service staffing and recruitment firm. And we work with not only job seekers, but employers. And last year, almost 4,000 individuals were placed into jobs through TalentBridge. And we recorded $1.2 million labor hours that were worked through TalentBridge. And then we have all the mission programs like Project Search. And this is an innovative program for young adults with disabilities. And the goal there is to help them develop job and social skills through on-site internship experiences that can eventually lead to, you know, competitive employment. And sites where we've had Project Search programs include the Milwaukee County Zoo and Mitchell Airport. So that's really, really very, very gratifying program to see these young adults with disabilities basically grow into these wonderful jobs.
So infiltrating a number of areas of the economy. We're talking with Pat Bolter, Chief Marketing Officer for Goodwill Industries of Southeastern Wisconsin. We're talking about how Goodwill has changed and things that have stayed the same in its 100 years of existence. You can join in 800-642-1234. Pat, there are many charities and nonprofits today that began when Goodwill of Southeastern Wisconsin started. Where does Goodwill kind of fit in with other charities and nonprofit groups that have come up through the decades?
Well, you know, over the past 100 years, really, Goodwill has developed some long-term relationships with other nonprofits in our service territory, and we collaborate on many different initiatives with them. And, you know, we realize that as an organization, we can't be everything to everyone. And so these collaborative relationships with other nonprofits really help us do a better job of serving our folks that we serve, because there's a lot of wraparound services that we're not experts in providing, but these nonprofits specialize in, whether that's housing or transportation, some of those types of services. We're all about training and jobs, so to have those additional partners providing kind of that, those wraparound services really increase chances of an individual being very successful on the job.
What does Goodwill do with donated items to get them ready to be sold in its retail locations?
Well, basically, you know, what we do is, we obviously, folks are aware of our 70 locations in our service territory where we process those donations and put them on the store floor. And basically, the sale of those items is reinvested in the mission programs and services that we have. So our goal is to put those items on our shelves and to be a very good steward of those donations that we get from our local community, but then trying to maximize the value of those donations so that those dollars can be reinvested in some of the programs and services that I mentioned.
How does Goodwill use the money to make it makes in the thrift stores on its job assistance programs? Where does it go?
Well, for example, one of the services I didn't mention that is available to anyone in our community is what we call the Workforce Connection Centers. And these centers provide free services for individuals like resume development and access to technology. And we have some basic computer workshops and job postings. And we actually have employers that come on site to interview job candidates. So we have three in the Milwaukee area and three in the Illinois marketplace. And we last year we helped almost 16,000 people at these sites. So again, this is a free service open to the public. No appointments are necessary. People just walk right in and say, I need help either getting a new job or maybe getting a better job. And then we go to work for you, again, free of charge, and provide you everything you need. You know, we all know that oftentimes if you lose a job, the first thing that goes is your technology. You know, you don't want to be paying for internet services when you're unemployed. So we have all that technology at these Workforce Connection Centers, because certainly the way that you apply for jobs and you get jobs these days has changed. So access to technology is critical in job searches.
Samantha in Menominee wants to know, are people with disabilities, are the employees paid minimum wage?
Yes, they are. We have no one that works in our organization that is paid below minimum wage. Everyone in our organization makes minimum wage and above. And we, I don't believe we have anybody even at the minimum wage. It's higher than that.
We have another question here. Is Goodwill privately owned?
Goodwill is a nonprofit organization, and there are about 157 Goodwill organizations across the country. Our Goodwill happens to be the largest in the entire world, this Goodwill, so we're really proud of that. We are a not-for-profit organization that reinvests our revenue into helping people with disabilities and disadvantages.
So if you can look into your crystal ball, Pat, where do you see Goodwill changing and evolving as you go forward here in the next 100 years?
Well, I think, you know, resale is becoming increasingly popular. You know, I read an article just the other day that is estimating that by the year 2028, about one-third of everyone's closet will be full of resale or gently used items. So, you know, you think about it, the whole sustainability push, you know, being friendly to our planet, is you know, it's been part of Goodwill since our inception. We're all about reducing and reusing and repurposing and recycling. So I think we're getting, there's certainly a group of individuals and millennials and Gen Zs where sustainability is really, really important to them. So I do see this incredible increase in resale. And then, of course, e-commerce. You know, e-commerce is becoming increasingly popular, especially when you look at the explosive trends of individuals that purchase online. So I think e-commerce is something that's certainly going to grow for Goodwill. But on the workforce side, you know, we have record unemployment. Full employment right now, mm-hmm. in the marketplace. Unemployment rates are as low as they've ever been. And with the aging of baby boomers and all those subsequent retirements, you know, we're really creating opportunities for folks or employers to look at some of those untapped labor pools, like persons with disabilities, individuals that have been incarcerated, or those who have had maybe minor drug violations. These are untapped labor pools. And as we face, you know, the retiring baby boomers and record low unemployment and the skills gap, more of those individuals, I believe, are going to get an opportunity to be employed and have careers and grow and support their families.
Pat, thank you for joining. We have to leave here, but Pat, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Pat Bolter, Chief Marketing Officer for Goodwill Industries of Southeastern Wisconsin. And for disclosure, Goodwill Industries South Central Wisconsin is a business sponsor of WPR. Coming up, we talk about women in a male-dominated space, football. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a note on our programming plans today. The Senate impeachment trial of President Trump resumes at noon, with the trial entering a new phase as senators are allotted time to ask questions. You can hear live NPR coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio's News and Classical Network and online at WPR.org. Here on the Ideas Network, we'll keep you informed of the latest and we'll invite you into the conversation. So right now, we're inside the world of semi-pro women's tackle football. Teams and leagues have been around for decades, but the sport is in a growth spurt. The league called the Women's Football Alliance includes the Midwest Mountain Lions, which is based in southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. And this spring, they play five teams around the Midwest. Do you have a daughter interested in football? Are you trying to field a team? What do you want to know about women's tackle football? We're at 800-642-1234. Mary Ellen Six is a receiver, defensive back, and kicker for the Midwest Mountain Lions. Mary Ellen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Great. Thanks for having us.
And Snoopy Schuster is head coach of the Midwest Mountain Lions, and they're joining us from our Milwaukee studios this morning. Snoopy, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Well, Snoopy, let's start with you. The Midwest Mountain Lions are a new team for Wisconsin, but this isn't the first time a professional women's football team has existed here. What is the history, the evolution of women's tackle football here in Wisconsin?
Well, we've had quite a few teams. We've had the Wisconsin Warriors, the Madison Blaze, the Wisconsin Wolves, the Milwaukee Momentum, the Chicago Force down in Illinois. We had the Kenosha Ice, which was a championship team. They won the championship, I think, in 2003. Sorry, I was looking to Six for help with that one. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's been a very rich history. We actually had a team called the Lake Michigan Meeks that was up in Green Bay area back in the late 60s.
Well, if nothing else, preserve these names somewhere. They're amazing. So how did your team, the Midwest Mountain Lions, evolve?
Well, the team that was previously operating in the same area, their owners, they decided that they were going to move to Minnesota, and we wish them the best. They got their dream job, and who can blame them for going? But then that left the vacuum. The Madison Blaze, which had been operating the year before, had folded. And so we just simply did not want it to die in this area. We've got a lot of women who really want to play, and we feel that women really deserve to play.
Mary Ellen, when you are talking with women about tackle football, what do you say about it, and is there interest?
Yeah, I think for women wanting to play, one of the biggest questions is, you know, well, I have no experience playing football, or I don't know how to play, or all the rules. And I would say to them, you know, we'll teach you everything. That's pretty common. Most people on our team haven't played football before. They've maybe played other sports, but as long as you're athletic and willing to learn, you can do it.
What has recruitment been like for you, Mary Ellen?
So it can be difficult to convince women who, you know, have full-time jobs and maybe kids to, you know, dedicate a chunk of their time to this. But we do our best to, you know, get the word out and show people how fun it is.
Snoopy, I understand you have 26 players right now. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
How does that size compare to other professional football teams?
If you mean the NFL, obviously we are way undersized for that. If you mean other teams in the league, we actually have a tier system. We actually use the same system as the NCAA. So we are considered a D3 team because we are so small. The D1 teams will have a roster of, you know, 60 to 80 players, but only 45 players are allowed to dress for that day.
And so when you have a smaller roster, you're needing your players to play different positions, I would assume, to be very multitasking.
Yes, as you could tell by the title introduction that you gave for Mary Ellen, which, you know, kicker. She's kicker, punter, receiver, D-back, you know, so obviously they have lots of play things. We always tell our players, too, that even if your primary position is, let's say, D-line, D-tackle, we want you to learn everything you can. Know the entire sport. Know what the person next to you is doing. Know what the person behind you is doing. Know what the person on the opposite side of the line is doing.
So being able to try out those different positions as well and, you know, play those positions, you may end up with a more well-rounded player.
Oh, amen. Yes, I started myself when I started with the Chicago Forest back years ago. They originally put me as a D-back, and then the next thing you know, I ended up at defensive end, and then in 2006, I actually went to the Pro Bowl as a defensive end.
Wow. What was that like going to the Pro Bowl?
Oh, my goodness. I was so thrilled. It was so exciting. I'm absolutely effusive now. You cannot see my hands, but I'm shaking them about.
So, where was it? Who did you play?
Well, for the Pro Bowl, obviously you play all the different players from all the different teams that have made the Pro Bowl. My claim to fame is that I blocked and was successfully getting off the blocks of the league MVP. And I was just so excited about that. That's my big claim.
Certainly, running a football team comes with a lot of costs. How are you able to pay for the equipment to suit up your players?
Well, part of it, a lot of it comes out of our pockets. It really does. But we do have a team fee, and we do call it a team fee. It's you're paying to be part of a team. You're not paying to play, because if you're not talented enough and you're not capable enough and I don't believe you're going to be safe enough out on the field, then you're not going to be playing much. But the team fee goes to pay for, you know, rental of practice fields and game fields and game equipment, announcers. There is so much money that is going out for us. We do try to get in sponsors. The league does have sponsors such as Glacier Clinics. Oh, my goodness. I love Glacier Clinics. They have been supportive of women's football way before they actually became an official team sponsor. But, yeah, we are always looking for local sponsors, always looking for people that will come in and help us out.
We're talking with Snoopy Schuster and Mary Ellen Six. They're co-owners of the Midwest Mountain Lions. That's a semi-pro women's tackle football team from Wisconsin and Illinois. Mary Ellen is a receiver, defensive back, and kicker, and Snoopy is head coach. Mary Ellen, how did you get into tackle football?
So I have always loved football since I was, you know, a kid, but there was no outlet for me to play. I played lots of other sports growing up. But as an adult, I actually was looking for a rec soccer team to play on and just happened across an ad for, you know, the team in the area and haven't looked back since.
Yeah, what hooked you? What do you love about it?
I just love the sport. I mean, I love, you know, it's an outlet to be, you know, you're hitting people and you're aggressive and it's in this controlled environment and it's just, you know, it's a rush.
But you're also hitting women. You know, what is that like?
I mean, it can be – it's an adjustment at first because, of course, you're doing things that in polite society you would never do otherwise. So you do need to get used to it. But, you know, it's amazing because it is – it's a rush.
What position do you like best, because you play a number of them?
Probably receiver has been the most fun for me.
If your team is practicing about once a week, is that right?
No, ma'am, twice.
Twice a week. How do you skill build? Because there's also a lot of training that I would assume that goes around football, not just on the field, but off the field as well, to build muscle and capacity and endurance. Mary Ellen, what is that like?
Yeah, so we encourage our players to do a lot of that, work in the gym outside of our practices, because you're right, within our practice time, there's a lot of, football skills and things we need to do as a team. We're really having to spend time outside of that to work on our physical conditioning.
Do you feel like your physical conditioning, it makes a difference on the field when you dedicate that time to doing other types of workouts?
Absolutely. I think, the more in shape you are, the stronger you are, the more safe you are on the field.
Snoopy, what do practices look like, especially for people who've never played before?
Well, early on in the season, like we are right now where it's preseason, the beginning practices are all about the basics. I want to make sure as head coach you're going to be safe when you hit the field. So I make sure that you know how to hit. I know how you can take a hit. We put a series of pads on the floor and you literally just stand there and then we hit you and you fall down. And I make sure you fall down in a way that, keeps you safe. We have pads that we have you run through, and I make sure that you're hitting with your shoulder, you're not leading with your head, that you are using good, proper form, in order to do these things.
Do women ever say, I can't do this? Or do you find that they stick with it and they just want more, Snoopy?
Oftentimes it's like it's a rush. They come in and, there's often an emotional component, like you talked about earlier, that very first I have to hit someone and, oh my goodness, I'm hitting someone. Oh my goodness, somebody's hitting me. But that then soon rolls into, oh my goodness, I get to hit someone and, oh my goodness, someone's hitting me. It is such a rush and it's excitement. And, to fly around on the field and to do stuff that you're normally not allowed to do, it's legalized violence.
Mary Ellen, you have teammates traveling from around Wisconsin and Illinois. What is that commuting like to get these players on the field?
Yeah, there are quite a few players who have, a journey of maybe 1 to 2 hours to get to practice. But I think it is, like Snoopy said, once you come, a lot of people are just hooked because it is such
adrenaline.
It's such an adrenaline rush. It's just such a fun thing that, people are willing to do it.
And so I would assume there's some carpooling going on?
Yeah, there is definitely some carpooling going on to get to practice.
We are inside the world of women's semi-pro full contact football. Snoopy Schuster, head coach of the Midwest Mountain Lions. Mary Ellen Six, a receiver, defensive back, and kicker for the team. Are you a female athlete who plays in a mostly male-dominated sport? What sport do you play? How do you motivate yourself? Does watching professional female athletes inspire you? Join in with your story, your questions, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment, more on the Midwest Mountain Lions with Mary Ellen Six and Snoopy Schuster right here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're learning about women's semi-pro full contact tackle football. The Midwest Mountain Lions practice in Sturtevant. Their season this spring will take them to games around the Midwest. Meanwhile, the San Francisco 49ers offensive assistant Katie Sowers played tackle football, and on Sunday, she'll become the first female member of an NFL staff to coach in a Super Bowl. Here she is on the NFL Network.
Being the first, it is historic. I mean, there always has to be a first to make change, but the most important thing that I continue to say is just to make sure I'm not the last.
Has Katie Sowers inspired you? Has she changed your views on the NFL? How should the NFL approach bringing more women to the sport? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Mary Ellen Six is a receiver, defensive back, and kicker for the Midwest Mountain Lions. Snoopy Schuster is head coach, and they stay with us from our Milwaukee studios. Mary Ellen, I understand you've played against Katie Sowers during her days as a professional football player. What was that like?
I did, yeah. I played against both Katie and her twin sister, Liz. And I can tell you, I remember leading up to that game that the game plan very much revolved around how to stop the Sowers sisters.
And what were they like on the field? What were their abilities?
They're both incredible athletes. They're great to play against, too, because they're both great people. So it was exciting and challenging.
Snoopy, how are the reffing and rules adjusted in any way for the women's tackle semi-pro sport versus what you see in men's football?
No, we use NCAA rules, so the same rules that apply to college football apply to us. The only difference we have is we instituted this year was we outlawed cut blocking.
And what does that mean?
Cut blocking is when you initiate contact below the waist. Unlike men's teams who have millions of dollars behind them and millions in their pocket, you know, we have to go home at the end of the day. We have to go back to our jobs, our children, our lives. So we are trying to be a little bit safer, so we do not allow that initiation below the knees or below the waist in order to protect our knees.
Are the refs female as well?
I don't think I've been in a game personally that's had a female ref, but I'm sure they're out there because we are everywhere.
I want to get your perspective, Snoopy, because gender barriers, something we're talking about a lot, not just on the sports field, but in many industries as well. What do you want people to understand or take away from as we see Katie Sowers and what women are doing in the NFL?
Well, the NFL does not have diversity quotas. The Rooney Rule initiated in 23 simply said that you have to interview a minority before hiring a position, and you only have to interview one minority. So anytime you see a woman or an African-American, a Hispanic-American, or anybody like that, we earned that job. We got there because we deserved it. And that applies, you know, like Lori Locust is a D-line coach in the NFL, you know, and you think of D linemen, you think these huge monster men, and yet, you know, she's my personal hero in the NFL as far as coaches go. When we are there, we deserve it. We earned it. We got there because we deserve it. I mean, I'm starting to babble. I apologize. But the reason Katie Sowers is getting attention, and as she deserves the attention, is because of the team she's on. But there's 10 women coaching in the NFL right now.
Where are they? What are their jobs? What is it like for them?
They are scattered throughout. Tampa Bay actually has two women on their staff. Again, Lori Locust, who is my personal hero. She coaches the D-line. But there are women throughout. The first woman that was hired in 2015 by the Arizona Cardinals. She was hired as an intern. The first full-time coach was in 2016 for the Buffalo Bills. She was a special teams coach. You know, so we are everywhere, and we encompass different positions in different, you know, parts of the field. You know, you think D-line, you know, Katie Sowers coaches, you know, the offensive coordinator position, but she mainly coaches the wide receivers. You know, people think little. They think women can, you know, little, but we also coach the bigs. We coach across the entire spectrum.
We're talking with Snoopy Schuster, head coach of the Midwest Mountain Lions. It's a newly formed semi-pro women's football team based in Wisconsin. Mary Ellen Six co-owns the team, plays as a receiver, defensive back, and kicker. Still time for your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's talk about concussions for a moment. The NFL announced that there were 214 diagnosed concussions in 2018. Snoopy, how are you accounting for that, and what do you make of that?
Full disclosure, I have TBI in my frontal temporal lobe from concussions. So I am absolutely adamant about safety. I teach the same foot, same shoulder technique, and until you master that technique and until you can go out there and protect yourself, protect your head, I'm not going to let you on the field. This can disrupt some people because they really want to get out there and they really want to hit and play. But if you can't do it safely, you can't do it.
What happened in your concussion? How did you get it?
Oh, I had multiple concussions, and I did the typical thing where you get the concussion and you really, really want to play, so you fib about your symptoms and you fib about your thing. And back when I got my first concussion, which is 2006, my head coach encouraged me to come back. My head coach encouraged me to play. And so I did. I actually got concussed every single game that season, and then I continued to play. And eventually I was on another team, and I was playing on that team, and my teammates refused to take the field with me anymore because they knew it was unsafe for me. And I call this thing concussion brain. It's a lot like being inebriated in that you think you can do things that you should not do. And so you get this concussion brain, and you think you can play. You think you can do it, you know. But your teammates, your coaches, your family, your staff, you know, on the team has to be the one to take control of it then and tell you no.
Let's take a call now. Laura in Manitowoc. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm listening to these ladies and I'm feeling inspired and I'm thinking it's great that they're going out and kind of, you know, bucking tradition and, you know, doing what they're doing. And I'm even thinking so far as, you know, gosh, I want to be a part of this, not as a player, but I realize that it would probably be in a volunteer capacity and I'd really like to work hard and further this effort until your guest started talking about how this is legalized violence, which I've always felt football really is. And, you know, no matter how you dress it up or, you know, what you call it, violence just, it's not a good thing. And I think this does really further and condone that. And I don't see how people can support this. So it's really deflated my enthusiasm after hearing that. And I'd like to like football, but this just really validates what I discussed with the whole sport.
Laura, thank you so much for sharing those comments and what is on your mind. Mary Ellen, would you like to field that?
Sure. I mean, you know, football is not a sport for everyone. If, you know, you're uncomfortable with that sort of contact, hitting someone, getting hit, you know, the sport may just not be for you, and that's okay. It does take a particular mindset to play the sport and to enjoy it.
Mary Ellen, as a player, of course, you wear plenty of pads and helmet, but this equipment has long been made to fit a male body types. Have you or other players struggled to find equipment that is safe and works for women's bodies?
Yeah, I would say the biggest problem is usually shoulder pads that are made for men. Our bodies are very different. So a lot of women do have trouble. There was a manufacturer for a while making shoulder pads designed for women. So sometimes we're able to get those, but it can be an issue.
Snoopy, I wanted to get you in here as well on Laura's comment about the violence. What would you tell her?
Well, it is violence. I'm not going to, you know, obviously I'm the one who said it, but it's also done in a safe way. It's done in a way that, you know, you get up at the end of it and you walk away. You know, you can take the frustrations of your kids or your boss or what's going on, and you can get this out in a way that you can hit and be hit, and it will give you the adrenaline, it will give you the joy, you know. So it's not violence in a negative way, it's violence in a positive way, if you can make that adjustment mentally.
Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you, Snoopy, for joining us, and Mary Ellen Six, thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Mary Ellen Six and her wife Snoopy Schuster co-own the Midwest Mountain Lions. They're a professional women's football team based in Wisconsin. Mary Ellen, receiver, defensive back, and kicker on the team. Snoopy, head coach. And they joined us from our Milwaukee studios. Check out our slideshow, by the way, on the morning show page at WPR.org. Just ahead, we discuss the history of pronouns and their influence on our culture. An author shares 40 years of research through his new book called What's Your Pronoun? I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.